ईश्वरस्य समग्रस्य वीर्यस्य यशसश्रियः ज्ञानवैराग्ययोश्चैव षण्णां भगितिङ्गना. All of these divine qualities taken together constitute the nature of Bhagavan, the personal God. Majesty, valor, fame, fortune, knowledge, and renunciation. Good morning, everyone. This morning, we will be talking about Bhagavan based on this one verse. And actually, this whole talk, it'll be two different sessions, this week and next Sunday, is based on a very interesting article that I read recently in a book called Purushottamam, Ramakrishna Purushottam, I think. Anyhow, it was written by Swami Amayanandaji, whom many of you know, who was in charge of Jardambati, the center, our center in Jardambati for many years. Now he's the head of the Andhaka ashram. Anyhow, I read this article and I was charmed by it, because what he did was he took all of these six bhagas. We sometimes wonder, Bhagavan, what does this word mean? Bhagavan. He's supposed to be one who possesses these six bhagas. Bhagas are these special qualities, these divine qualities. So he took this verse that I chanted, which is from the Vishnu Purana, and one by one he went through all of these qualities or virtues and tried to show how Sri Ramakrishna manifested them in his own life. So I thought I would use that as a basis for the talk. It turned into two talks. And expand on that theme. So today's version, sort of session, will be mostly an introduction to this, and we'll get to each one individually next Sunday. But I wanted to start out with this idea of Bhagavan. What do we mean by Bhagavan? We have so many different terms that we use for God. In English, we have one term which makes it simple, but it also doesn't allow room for any subtleties, any subtle distinctions that we have in different concepts. In the Vedantic tradition, we have so many different terms that are used. Sometimes it's confusing and sometimes it's helpful. It should be helpful because each one represents a different conception, not a different God, but a different conception of God. So we'll see these terms being used, Brahman, and sometimes nirguna, sometimes saguna, sometimes the impersonal absolute, sometimes Brahman with qualities. Then Ishwara, the creator, the Lord, we can say Paramatman, Purusha, and on and on, lots of different terms that we have. There's a verse from the Bhagavata Purana that is extremely important, especially for the followers of Chaitanya, that particular Gaudiya Vaishnava school. And this was taken by one of the six Goswamis, Jiva Goswami, and this one verse he turned into six huge volumes, which represent the entire philosophy of the Chaitanya school, the Vaishnava school, all based on one single verse. I know I had to go through all of this when I... So I know all about this. But it's very interesting. So he wrote something called the Shat Sandarbha, or the Bhagavata Sandarbha. It's six treatises, all revolving around this one verse. So let me start with this verse. It says, Vadanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yajjnanam advayam brahma iti paramatma iti bhagavan iti shabdyate. So the tattvavids, vadanti tat tattvavidas, the knowers of truth or reality, tattva. Tattva literally means thatness. Whatever that reality is, the essence of that reality, they call that or they regard that non-dual knowledge. So it's jnanam advayam, that non-dual knowledge. They regard that non-dual knowledge or consciousness to represent truth or reality. So this tattva, they're saying that what we call this infinite absolute, non-dual consciousness. That's the ultimate tattva. That's the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. Then they say, this is called Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. So, three different terms that are being used that all represent, ultimately, in the final analysis, ultimately, that same non-dual consciousness, that pure absolute consciousness. There's a very remarkable verse. It's a highly non-dualistic, highly philosophical verse, recognizing both the impersonal and personal aspects of reality. This dual nature of God, personal and impersonal, both. It recognizes the legitimacy of using different concepts in different terms and addressing this ultimate reality in different ways according to our own understanding. So in Vedanta, this is very important. We find that we're allowed to approach this reality from our own individual and particular point of view. That it's equally legitimate. The way we see this reality is the way anyone else does. Our understanding may not be as subtle as someone else's, or it may not work as well, but still, it's that same reality that we're trying to apprehend and trying to explain in our own way. So this verse harmonizes these different concepts of God and different paths. Because there's another important verse. This is from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which explains that Brahman, not only are these the same, represent the same reality, but they are for followers of different spiritual paths or different yogas. So it says that Brahman, the infinite impersonal absolute, is specifically for those following the path of Jnana Yoga. So the jnanis, those who are philosophical in nature, for them, they'll approach this ultimate reality with the understanding that it's Brahman, impersonal, absolute. Then Paramatman, that higher self within the whole universe, but specifically the higher self within, this is for the followers of Raja Yoga. They're not as much interested in seeing this infinite transcendent Brahman as seeing that same Brahman manifest within as their higher self. When we become very still and calm in meditation, we have that direct experience. So Paramatman. And then Bhagavan, personal God, specifically for those following the path of devotion or bhakti yoga. Now what we have here really is a classic example of a linguistic distinction between connotation and denotation. I talk about this a lot because I think it's very helpful from the Vedantic point of view. We may have very different ways of referring to something or say a particular person. We use different attributes, different qualities. We understand a person differently. We may even have two people talking about the same person thinking it's a different person. But it's the same person. So the connotation may be very different. Denotation will be the same. We're referring to one and the same reality. There are some classic examples that are given. One is of what's called the morning star and the planet Venus. We see in the evening in a certain position in the sky, a luminous body there, which we call the Venus. Then say we go to sleep, we wake up in the morning, a different part of the sky, we see another luminous body that is shining, it looks like a star, we call it the morning star. It's actually the same. They're one and the same, but we don't realize it. And even if we did realize it, they look different, they're in different places, we see them at different times. So the connotation is different, but the denotation is the same. Some of you may remember some time back I gave the example of Superman and Clark Kent. Now this is specifically to show how the connotation sometimes is completely opposite. Completely opposite. What is the nature of Superman? He's fearless, courageous. And Clark Kent, he was a little bit shy and cowardly. Right. And then Superman, X-ray vision. He can see through anything. Clark Kent, he had to wear thick glasses, could barely see. Right? And then Superman, agile, athletic and everything. Clark Kent, kind of a klutz, falling over himself. But are they two different people? The same, one and the same. So these illustrations are meant to show how we can have reference to one and the same reality, but our understanding is so completely different. Now, this is basically to show that when, at least this last illustration, what we call jiva, this small, limited human being that's a little bit klutzy and a little bit cowardly and everything, is really non-different from that ultimate Paramatman, that Supreme Self or Brahman, Superman. So, denotation is the same, referring to that same reality, but the connotation is very much different. Now, how does this apply to this idea of Bhagavan? Bhagavan, we won't get too technical, we'll simply say the personal God. Now, let's take an illustration of an individual. We may not know who we're talking about, we don't know the name, we may see someone from a distance, right? And we see it looks like someone is approaching us, and we try to think, what is our conception of that person from a great distance? Now, all we can do is speak in general terms, because we don't know anything in particular. Since we're Vedantins on some level, we may say that, well, we know that there's some type of combination of physical present, and then there'll be some soul within, some combination of spirit and matter. We can go that far. Or if we're very philosophical, we can say, yes, there's pure consciousness approaching us with the coverings of these five different sheaths, this physical and the mental and all of the other sheaths that we read about. Or we may even say that, yes, we see that there's a physical body there, and within, which is like a container filled with water, and the water is like the mind, and the sun is reflected into all these high philosophical ideas. So we can say that really it's Brahman itself approaching us in the guise of a human being. So in short, who was approaching us? The absolute Brahman. We don't know if the person is a thief or a saintly person. We don't know anything about that person, but we can say that much because it's from a great distance. Now, again, without knowing this person, we can say that, again, very philosophically, just as inside the jar there's space, outside the jar there's space, we know that that divine presence is manifested within them in a special way, even though space is one, but still in a special way, within the heart and mind of that individual, that higher self. God is manifest as the higher self. So we can say Paramatman is also approaching us. So there's a Paramatman, which is the same Brahman, but no longer thinking of that Brahman as that the sun, the transcendent sun manifest, but it's actually having entered into the individual as the higher self within. Okay. Now, suppose we inquire about the nature of this person from a lower point of view, not a high metaphysical point of view. We want to say, well, who is this person, actually? And someone will say, well, it's a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or something like that. And as the person gets closer and closer, we recognize that person, and we find out that this is actually someone that we know. And now all of these different qualities and characteristics come into the mind. And we say, yes, I know this person. This person is a very wealthy businessman, very powerful person. Or we say that this is a very kind, sweet person. And the particulars come out. Now, this is an example given in the devotional scriptures that the closer we get to that reality, the more we see the particular features of that reality. So this is the rationale for the concept of Bhagavan in the devotional scriptures. Because we see Brahman from a distance, we only see that massive brilliance, that radiant light. We get a little closer, we see there's an individual there. and that that light is within, is the higher self within. And when we get even closer, we see it's not a stranger at all. It's our own very own mother, our very own father, or our beloved, our friend, our child. We have that type of experience, and this is that concept of Bhagavan. So Brahman, from a great distance, a little closer, Paramatman, then we, when we come face to face with that reality, then this idea of Bhagavan. Now, the opposite is equally true. And this is, as I say, this is from the devotional point of view, where they'll place the personal God highest. And then a little bit lower is Paramatman, and then the lowest is Brahman, because it's from a distance, and we're not seeing all the particular features of it. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, he accepted all the different views, but sometimes he would talk about the view of the jnanis. They would say that, he would be asked, why does Kali look black? And he said, because we're from a great distance. It's like the sky. The sky looks blue from a distance. If we go close to it, we see there's no color at all. Or the water looks blue from a distance. But go and take some water in your hand, you'll see that it's colorless. So that means, from the point of view of the jnani, that we see all of these attributes and distinctions and differences and particularities because we're from a distance. We get closer and closer, we see that it's formless, ultimate reality. We can appreciate both of these ideas. We don't have to say one is right or one is wrong, or one is higher or one is lower. Anyhow, this does raise some important questions. And to me, these are the toughest questions. This idea of Brahman, philosophically, it's difficult, but it's very logical. Paramatman, very logical. When we get to the personal God, then sometimes we have our doubts. How real is the personal God? How real are the attributes? How much are we projecting of our own ideas? How much is subjective and how much is objective? Even this idea, male or female, we talk about this personal God sometimes as the Divine Mother. All right? Now, is this, again, just our own projection? If it's one with the ultimate Brahman, then it's beyond male or female. All of that. So these questions come up. The jnani will say that even our own self sense of identification is a false superimposition of these qualities on that supreme absolute consciousness within. So how can we say that the attributes that we're saying belong to God are ultimately real? If they're not ultimately real with us, how can they be ultimately real with God? If this jiva itself is something transcending individuality, then how can we say that the Supreme is an individual? If our personality is just a combination of different concepts and ideas that we have about ourselves, then how can it be ultimately real for Bhagavan? So this is what the jnani will say. And even from our own point of view, suppose we're talking about someone that we know very well, and someone says, can you describe that person? What are the qualities of that person? It's very hard to say. We can live with the person a whole lifetime, and that person will do something, will say, how could they do that? I thought I knew that person. How could they say something like that? Yeah, and then sometimes we'll say, after living with that person for 50 years, I realized I didn't know that person at all. Right? And even with ourselves, how well do we know ourselves? So it's clear that when we start to describe the personal God with particular attributes and everything, there's at least something subjective about it. At least that much we have to say. Now, this question of it, is there anything objective about it, is it, again, an interesting question. We find that there are two different answers to this subjective-objective dilemma, we can say. In the Gita, we get the impression a little bit that God himself reveals himself to us in the form that we most want to see. Even Sri Ramakrishna speaks in these terms sometimes. So that means that there is some objective manifestation. God himself will reveal himself in that form. The other idea is that it's our own longing which will let that formless, impersonal reality appear to us in a particular form. This is the idea that Sri Ramakrishna talks about when he says that this devotional power, this love that the devotee has, it's like this him shakti, this power, cooling power, which will allow water to form into blocks of ice. And the particular shape and form and name of the block of ice will depend on the nature of the devotion of the individual. It's just like scooping water out of a pond. The water will take the shape of the container that we use. That container will be our own heart, our own mind, our own conception of God. It won't be anything absolute. It'll take a particular form, but it doesn't change the fact that water is formless. And Sri Ramakrishna says that even after the water forms into blocks of ice, when the sun of knowledge comes up, it melts back into the ocean, becomes one with the ocean again. So there's a subjective element, there's an objective element. Swami Vivekananda, it sometimes will give an entirely subjective explanation, which is also a beautiful explanation. He'll say, really, who are we praying to? We're praying to the higher self within, only we're projecting it outside of ourselves and calling it the personal God, and we're projecting all of the attributes that we think are lordly attributes, saintly attributes, on God because of our own conception. So he says, if a water buffalo wants to worship God, what will the conception of God be for the water buffalo, a huge water buffalo, a big, strong, huge water buffalo? So we know that this is true to a certain extent, that we superimpose different ideas on the personal God according to our own understanding. And if we look at the history of religious strife, it's because of this mostly, that we have some conception, because I am a jealous person and an angry person, that God is also jealous and angry. And because I like certain people and dislike other people, God also likes certain people. He likes us and doesn't like the others. Right. God bless America. So we have this conception that just leads to, you know, quarrels among different religions. Now, it doesn't mean that there isn't a basic truth to this idea of Bhagavan, only that it's very hard to pinpoint what the real nature of Bhagavan is like. For our purposes, it's enough if we recognize that there's a power greater than us. Right? There's a power greater than us, the source of our existence that sustains us, that dwells within as that higher presence, that the source of love and joy within us, that we feel that we can turn to and get some strength and understanding from, that inner guide within that higher consciousness, however we understand it. So this is, we can say in some sense, the attitude of the wave towards the ocean. The wave recognizes that, yes, it really belongs to the ocean, it's a part of the ocean, but it recognizes that it has no existence without the ocean, that the ocean is something vast and tremendous, the source of everything, and worships the ocean, and gets strength from knowing it belongs to the ocean, and can understand that the real nature of the ocean in any way that appeals to it. That's the subjective aspect of this whole thing. So Sri Ramakrishna says that with this attitude we'll say that, yes, the wave belongs to the ocean doesn't belong to the wave. So we won't necessarily equate ourselves, I am that ocean, I'm a part of that ocean. In terms of water, I'm one with it. In terms of my manifestation, I'm just part of that ocean. So for Sri Ramakrishna, it boiled down to partly how we understand ourselves. If we see ourselves in a limited fashion, we'll see that personal God is unlimited. So he says, because the stick of ego lies on the surface of the water, we separate it into two different sides. And we see that large side as Brahman or the personal God, however, and we see ourselves on the other side. But we know that we all belong to that same body of water. Even the scriptures will explain this personal God in terms of Maya. There's a little bit of Maya involved here. Maya simply means we're taking that absolute and bringing it down into the relative. We're seeing it in terms of time, space, and causation. So even for Brahman to become the Ishvara, even for Brahman to create, it does it with the help of Maya. It does it with the help of some power which allows the infinite absolute reality to somehow take on some relative power and strength and function in the manifold world like that. So the Brahman itself, together with Maya, gives us this creator and this personal God, just as the individual also is nothing but that pure consciousness plus a little bit of Maya. But there's a vast difference. The scriptures say that the relationship between Maya and Brahman is one where Brahman is in control. Brahman is not tied down, is not bound by Maya, where the jiva is bound by Maya in the sense of ignorance. So we find this expression, Maya Baddha Jiva, Maya Mukta Shiva. The jiva is that same ultimate reality bound by Maya, and Shiva, that same ultimate reality, free from Maya. So this has actually a second meaning also, that we as individuals, when we become free from Maya, that free from ignorance, then we become Shiva. So that idea is also there. So these qualities that we'll be looking at and attributes of the personal God, all the different names and forms that we have for all the different aspects of God, may not have an absolute existence. They melt when the sun of knowledge comes. So it's not a permanent absolute existence, although sometimes Sri Ramakrishna says that some places where it's so cold, nothing melts. But in general, we can say that. But they certainly have a relative existence, which corresponds perfectly to the relative existence of the individual, of the jiva. So as long as we have that sense of ourselves as individuals, we'll have that sense of God as a personal God. So Swamiji says that, and it's a very interesting statement, that the personal God is every bit as real as you and I are. Now, if we think that we're 100% real, then the personal God is 100% real. If we think that my own individuality is 100% false, then I'll say ultimately this personal God is nothing but Brahman. But there's a perfect correspondence. How we understand ourselves and how we understand God are perfectly linked, microcosm and macrocosm. But the one thing that we can't deny is that this worship of the personal God, however we understand it, even if we know that it's to a large extent subjective, this worship of the personal God and devotion to the personal God is extremely helpful in spiritual life. It allows for the heart to expand for a devotion, and one of the best means of realizing God, either in personal form or as the impersonal absolute. And this is why Sri Ramakrishna says that even bhakti yoga will lead us to that same knowledge of Brahman, that same oneness. Only we do it through this worship of the personal God. Now, so far, we've seen half of the meaning of Bhagavan. This is only half of it. Bhagavan is the personal aspect of God as worshipped by his devotees, like the ocean, which is the support and the source of all of the individual waves. Seeing that with great reverence, with great devotion, the individual wave will worship that ocean. Now, we also know from time to time that there'll be another individual wave that'll be a huge wave, a tsunami. That's a huge wave, so huge that We almost look for another way to define it. We give it a different name. It's a wave, and we recognize that it's a wave, and it behaves like a wave. But it has such strength and such power that we get a much better understanding, at least, of the nature of the entire ocean by seeing that wave. This is the avatar. Again, however we understand it, whether we say, oh, the personal God has taken human form, or whether we say because of dharma, there's some historical imperative that's causing this special manifestation to take place. However we understand it, we see that there's something different about this wave. And by worshipping this wave or meditating on this wave, we get a better sense of the majesty and grandeur of the ocean than we do from our limited vision of the ocean itself. How much of the ocean can we see? Right. How much we say we want to worship the Brahman, the Supreme Absolute Reality. How much of that do we know? It's unknown to us. But this avatar, or these great souls, these special souls who have a special mission, whatever, are standing right before us. They're the best representatives we have of these divine qualities that we're talking about that in here in Bhagavan. So we'll see that our conception of the personal God as being loving and compassionate is limited to our own understanding of love and compassion, which may be, you know, filled with selfishness and smallness. But we see an example in front of us of pure selfless love and compassion, much greater than any conception we can have. Even if there's no being that has it, theoretically, I'm trying to imagine the highest type of love, selfless love. It's limited because I don't possess it, but I see it standing before me. So there, this is why Swamiji says that the worship of these great souls, these avatars, gives us a higher conception of God than we could come up with on our own. Even if we understand that God is the highest conception of love and compassion, still, this is a better example for us. Now, the interesting thing is that even for the jnani may not accept this idea that there is such a thing as a personal God at all. Jnani may say, no, Brahman ultimately is impersonal, and this idea of the personal God is strictly our own superimposition of human qualities on God. They don't belong there. Even for the jnani can say, yes, but I see these special souls who were born. I don't have to describe them as avatars. I don't have to say anything. I don't have to say that, well, God in heaven one day thought, well, there's trouble on earth, let me come down to earth. None of that. But even for the jnani can say, this is the best example of the highest ideal of these virtues. If we meditate on them and pay reverence to them, then they'll manifest within us. So we can have someone like Swami Vivekananda, who is the greatest jnani, but he'll have the highest devotion to personal God in human form. And this is the other a way that the term Bhagavan is used. Bhagavan is used for the divine incarnation or for these great souls. And even those who don't believe in divine incarnation sometimes will use this term Bhagavan just as the highest term of respect. We see with Ramana Maharshi, for example, he is referred to as Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi. And this is a tradition that no one will go about worshipping him and waving lights and saying that he's divine incarnation. It just shows that it's a sign of reverence to someone who has reached that highest stage of perfection. And any individual who reaches that highest stage of perfection, who manifests these divine qualities, can be meditated upon and can be shown the highest reverence, if not worship, at least the highest reverence that way. So this is a very interesting thing about this concept of Bhagavan. There's no distinction made. It's just as often used to refer to the personal God as it is to the avatar. And the reason for that is that they're considered to be really one and the same. when we look at Gita, Gita is the best example of this. First of all, it's called Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad means Bhagavan, so the song of God. And we see that whenever Sri Krishna is speaking, it says Bhagavan Uvacha, the Lord said. And sometimes he's speaking in terms that are applicable to his role as the charioteer and the friend of Arjuna. Other times he's speaking from the point of view of Ishvara, or the personal God. So he'll say things like, I am the Self within all beings. Now clearly he's not talking about the charioteer. How can he be the Self within all beings? He's talking about that Bhagavan as one with Brahman or Ishvara. I am the Self within all beings. I am the knower of the field within each and every body. Everything comes from me. Everything goes back to me. All of these statements are made by the same Krishna, who is equally Bhagavan as the divine incarnation and Bhagavan as the source of the divine incarnation. So we read Krishna to Bhagavan Swayam, but Krishna is Bhagavan himself. So perfect identification between the incarnation and the source of the incarnation. Because really, in the devotional scriptures, one of the most important aspects of personal God is the divine incarnation. There's far more worship of Krishna than there is of Narayana. Narayana will be the source of it, but the sweetness and joy comes from the human manifestation. So that's what becomes more popular. Even in Christianity, the life and teachings of Christ have become far more important. The Son is more important than the Father. And we'll even hear people say Christ is Lord himself. All right, so the tendency of the human mind is to cling to that which it can relate to. So this is that Bhagavan aspect in human form. So, whether we accept a very formal understanding of avatar, that the personal God has come in human form, or whether we say that this avatar is simply a huge wave, a great soul, special soul who manifests these divine qualities, we can have that same reverence in either case. We sing Om Hrim Ritang every night here, and we have that line, Om Namah Shri Bhagavate Ramakrishnaya. Shri Bhagavate. Bhagavate means to Bhagavan. But we're free to understand it in any way. It can be used just as a term of highest reverence, or it can be used, Avatara Varishta, to refer to him as wonderful divine incarnation. That's up to us. And Swamiji's point, which he stressed very much, was, let others decide how they want to look upon Sri Ramakrishna, whether he was a divine incarnation or a great realized soul or a prophet, however they understand him. But let them see that through reverence to him, meditating on his life, trying to follow his teachings, all of that, one can attain the highest. That's the more important thing. Now, one more, we can say, last footnote before next week we start with these individual six qualities. When we look at the life of Sri Ramakrishna, we find that he manifests all of these qualities in a very different way. Most of these are big, strong, heroic things we're talking about. And Sri Ramakrishna, he could hardly walk from one place to another without someone holding him up. He didn't manifest that great heroism, that great strength that we see in Rama of Ramayana, or even Krishna as the charioteer. In many respects, he was the exact opposite. But he embodied these all in his own special, sweet, charming way, we can say. Now, one of the reasons for this can be found in certain statements that Sri Ramakrishna himself made regarding his own human birth. On several occasions, he mentioned the fact that this time he came in secret. This time. Meaning that he had this conviction that he had come before in the form of these other avatars. So this time, referring to himself and Holy Mother and his direct disciples. He used to say that just as a band of minstrels, bowls, these bowls are folk singers in Bengal, just as they seemingly show up out of nowhere, they sing a few songs, they play their instruments, they dance a little bit, then they're gone. Nobody knows where they came from, nobody knows where they lived for. He said, just like that, we came and we sang and did our little dance, and then we left, and everyone will say, wow, where did they come from and where did they go to? So he said, this time everything is a little bit in secret. He said, like the king who wants to observe the subjects of his kingdom and knows that if he comes dressed as the king, that everyone will try to impress him and no one will behave in the typical normal way that they do. So he comes incognito. He comes unrecognized. He dresses himself up as an ordinary peasant like all of the others to walk around the kingdom and see how everything is going on. So he said that this is the way he came. So with all of these kingly attributes kept in secret, came in disguise a little bit. And this is why during his lifetime very few people recognized Sri Ramakrishna as the great soul that he was. A handful of people, we can say. Sometimes he would say that if a small boat goes down a river, it can go near the shore. And when it passes the shore, some waves will come and they'll come up on the bank of the river. It won't cause much of problems or anything. But a big steamship will go down the center of the river, and it'll take a long time before the waves come and reach the shore, but they'll create tremendous havoc. They'll even break off parts of the shore and everything, but by the time they get there, the steamship is out of sight. So he said that these divine incarnations are like that, that it's not till many years after they're passing away that the tremendous force is felt. It's now 150 years since Sri Ramakrishna passed away, and we're just starting to see that tremendous power engulf the world, for all over the world, tremendously. So this is a sign of the amount of spiritual power that was embodied in Sri Ramakrishna. Other times we'll see these great teachers will come, and they'll have a big following even during their lifetime. And then after they pass away, slowly it dies out and there's nothing left after a while. It doesn't mean they're not also highly realized souls and powerful souls and everything, but there's something different with these special souls we call these avatars. And their power can go on for centuries and centuries. We see with Buddha, Christ, and others how this tremendous power manifests itself. Now, this description of Bhagavan with the six characteristics that we find in this Vishnu Purana mention them as Aishwarya, which is lordliness. And this Aishwarya comes from Ishwara. So this will be an important distinction. So lordliness, majesty, glory. Then Virya, heroism, strength, courage. Then we have Yashas, fame, recognition, renown. Shri can mean lots of things. Wealth, fortune, prosperity. It can also mean auspiciousness and beauty. Jnana, or knowledge, wisdom. And Vairagya, renunciation, dispassion, detachment. Now, we'll go through all of these one by one, but there's a very important distinction that I want to make. And this goes to the very first term, Aishwarya, because sometimes we'll get two completely different sets of lists. One will include all of the Aishwarya ones. That means that even though it's the first of this list, all of them fall within it. There's a heroism, valor, all of these things. These are all lordly attributes. There's a whole different set called Madhurya, the sweet attributes. Now, if we simply do these, we may think that we're only getting half of the whole story, but we'll see that Sri Ramakrishna combined both of them. All of these he manifested in his own sweet way. But there are some devotional schools that will say that the Aishwarya, these lordly ones, refer to Ishwara or Bhagavan as the personal God, and the Madhurya, the sweet ones, refer to Bhagavan as the divine incarnation, and that the lower, the Madhurya, the sweet ones, are much higher than the others. I want to read just a very brief description of these from the some of these highly devotional traditions. Aishwarya, opulence, splendor, magnificence, majesty, supremacy. In regard to bhakti, this refers to devotion which is inspired by the opulence and majesty of the Lord, especially in his feature as Lord Narayana. So that means up in heaven somewhere. So this personal God. This type of devotion restricts the intimacy of exchange between Bhagavan and his devotees. Okay, so this is that idea that if we look upon God with great power and strength and everything, that intimacy won't be there. And then, madhurya, sweetness or beauty. In regard to bhakti, this refers to devotion which is inspired by attraction. Of course, these are all Krishna schools. Attraction to Krishna's sweet and intimate feature as a beautiful young cowherd boy. They won't care so much for Krishna or the Gita or anything. It'll be either as a Gopala or a Govinda. This type of devotion allows for the greatest exchange of love between him and his devotees. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, to a certain extent, held this view and also spoke about this Aishwarya, this lordliness and wealth and splendor and everything, telling his devotees not to get too enamored with all of these things. So we find some very interesting exchanges. Sri Ramakrishna was talking to Keshav and the other members of the Brahmo Samaj. Why do members of the Brahmo Samaj dwell so much on God's glories, Aishwarya? Is there any great need of repeating such a thing as, O God, thou hast created the moon, the sun, and the stars? Most people are filled with admiration for the garden only. How few care to see its owner. Who is greater, the garden or its owner? After a few drinks at a tavern, do I care to know how many gallons of wine are stored there? One bottle is enough for me. When I met Narendra, I never asked him, who is your father? How many houses does he own? Shall I tell you the truth? Man loves his own riches, and so he thinks that God loves his too. He thinks that God will be pleased if we glorify his riches. Once, Shambhu Malik, said to me, please bless me that I may die, leaving my riches at the lotus feet of God. I answered, these are riches only to you. What riches can you offer God? To him these are mere straw and dust. Once a thief broke into the temple of Vishnu and robbed the image of its jewels. Mathur Babu and I went to the temple to see what was the matter. Addressing the image, Mathur said bitterly, what a shame, Lord. You were so worthless. The thief took all the ornaments from your body and you couldn't do a thing about it. Thereupon I said to Mathur, shame on you. How improper your words are. To God, the jewels you talk so much about are only lumps of clay. Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, is his consort. Do you mean to say that he should spend sleepless nights because a thief has taken your few rupees? He's the one who paid, of course, for all his jewelry. You mustn't say such a thing. Can one ever bring God under control through wealth? He can be tamed only through love. What does he want? Certainly not wealth. He wants from his devotees love, devotion, feeling, discrimination, and renunciation. Now, mentioning all of this so that we don't think that all of the qualities mentioned in this Vishnu Purana that we'll go through exhaust all of the attributes of Bhagavan. This idea of love and compassion and mercy very often is side by side with the idea of strength and justice and that hard side. That's why sometimes we have this idea of male and female combined, the hard side and the soft side, like that. And these are equally important, but We'll see when we come to Sri Ramakrishna that he combines them, that all of these Aishwarya, these lordly qualities, were manifest in him and in a very pure, in a very loving and sweet way. That's why he said, this time the Lord has come, meaning himself, with the glory, with the Aishwarya of Sattvaguna. There's a little rajas in the others. With the glory of Sattvaguna, like a king disguised as a beggar, visiting the various places in his kingdom. The glories, Aishwarya, of the Sattvaguna are discrimination, renunciation, love, compassion, forgiveness, and so on. So this is the general introduction. We'll see that next week, Sri Ramakrishna, he had moods where he manifested his power and strength. He did. There were certain times when we see that, but more often we'll find that he manifested all of these bhagas, all of these attributes, in his own very sweet and charming way, a very simple way, revealing this madhurya, the sweet element to it. So let's sit for a few minutes now and reflect on some of these ideas. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma mrityamgamaya avir mayeti rudrayate dakshanam mukham te namam pahi nityam om shanti 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 hari om tatsat. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om peace, peace, peace be unto you.